Let's get this going. I'm pleased to introduce Paul Cech, world-renowned holistic health practitioner and founder of the Cech Institute and PPS Success. Welcome, Paul.
Hello. Sorry I was a little delinquent there. It's probably a good lesson for everybody that no matter how organized you think you are, you can still trip over your own organization. So that's what you call being in the Tao.
Right.
Not making a big deal out of it when it's not a big deal. But as James alluded to, I was going to give a little explanation as to how the whole PPS program got started. So I think I'll start right there. First and foremost, several years ago, my wife came to me and she just whispered in my ear that she had noticed that the students that I had done private coaching with had typically gone on to be very, very successful. And she felt that in order for the Cech Institute to be successful, I was going to not only need to teach my students about corrective exercise and holistic health, but I needed to teach them the things that were the most likely things they'd have to learn in order to be successful in life and in business. So I thought, well, that's a truism right there, so I better take a serious look at that. So what I did is I began analyzing my career as a holistic health practitioner and looking at all the times I had to help professional athletes and business people and literally people from every walk of life to get through what I call a roadblock to success. When I put all that down on paper, I had clearly identified 12 key areas where people commonly got stuck. And those 12 key areas just happened to be areas where I myself had been stuck many times and had to learn things the hard way. So the PPS lessons are not theory for me. They're my own life experience. And you'll see that the lessons are very practical. There's not a bunch of head stuff. It's really just going through a process of getting to know yourself and getting clear on how you want to express yourself in life. And the first and most important lesson of the lessons is lesson one, because the number one reason people have problems in their life is they're not really sure what they're intending to do with themselves or with their life. Additionally, most people don't have what I call core values. They basically exist exactly as their parents programmed them to exist, and that is a very, very important word in this regard, because most of them were really programmed by their parents. Very few people were essentially taught how to think for themselves and how to live. So until we learn to establish our own core values and be clear on how we're using our energy and what we want to create, then it's very, very easy to find yourself trapped in the, you know, what I'll refer to as the mundanities of life. Little unnecessary things that don't really amount to much. The next lesson is PPS Lesson 2. And PPS Lesson 2, if you talk to the other PPS practitioners, is what we'll call the lesson. PPS Lesson 2 is all about understanding what I would refer to as information technology. We call ideas, when we're speaking technically, an idea is called a meme. M-E-M-E. Rhymes with cream. And a meme is basically any idea that can be replicated. So things go better with Coke is a meme that we've all, most of us have been infected with. So a meme is essentially an idea virus. And once it gets into the system, it becomes a self-replicating organism. Once you get things go better with Coke in your head, you may not ever be able to get it out of there. I can remember, for example, when I was a child, there used to be a commercial, and the commercial was for a company called The Bay, which is a kind of a department store in Canada, like a clothing company. And they had a commercial on television that had a jingle that went 317 at the Bay. And I could literally go anywhere in Canada right now, and if I started singing that jingle, everybody would know exactly what I was talking about, because it's a virus that infected almost the entire population of Canada over time. And that's exactly why these things are there, because every time you find yourself singing, you know, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, or Don't Step on My Blue Suede Shoes, or whatever, these ideas are inextricably woven in everything that was happening in your life at that time. Certain songs will remind people of painful events in their life. Maybe it was what was playing in the background at a restaurant when their spouse told them they wanted a divorce, or maybe it was playing on a car radio when you had a car accident, or maybe it was what was playing when you got married, or some other special event. But either way, what you'll find is in mind, all ideas are essentially interconnected. They need each other. For example, the idea of things going better with Coke is connected to the idea that you go to the store. And the idea of going to the store is connected with the idea of getting food. And so what you'll see is the idea of getting food is connected with the idea of farming. The idea of farming is connected to the idea of the earth. The earth is connected to the idea of the solar system. And it just goes on and on and on until the ideas become larger and larger, at which point they become archetypes. And then beyond archetypes, you are into no thing. There's nothing there. So once we learn how to establish core values and we get clear on what are the 10 components of a legacy and which do we have in place and which do we need to develop, then what we do from that point on is we move forward into lesson 3, which is goal setting. Now, the goal setting lesson is probably the most important of all. It is important once you've learned the other ones, because if you don't understand the process of goal setting, then all sorts of interesting things can happen to you. One, you can find yourself trying to do everything at once. And that's the most common problem I have with my students. They're trying to take multiple courses at one time, read multiple books at one time, deal with multiple people's lives at one time, and everything they do is in multiples. So in the goal setting section, I take everything you've learned in lesson 1 and lesson 2 and I bring it into a matrix so that you can then channel yourself effectively. And I've developed a system for monitoring your goals related to the development of yourself, which we call I goals, goals related to relationships, which we call we goals, and then goals related to your contribution to your legacy or humanity or life itself, which we call all goals. And then I teach what are called process goals, in other words, ways to enjoy the experience, and outcome goals, which are the type of goals most people set. And most people setting outcome goals find themselves frustrated because they don't often enjoy the process of achieving the goal, so it's kind of like pulling teeth to get there. Because I saw so many people failing in achieving their goals due to the fact that the process was so arduous that they couldn't bear to wait for the outcome, I developed a concept called process goals so that people could set achievable short-term goals and also bring their awareness to the process of the experience that they're going through and to help them remember that there's no point in having core values, legacy, understanding communication technologies, and setting goals if life is just a hell of a drag while you're doing it. So the first three lessons are what I call the foundation lessons. And the foundation lessons are really the basis from which the other program or the other lessons build from. And if we don't do well at the foundation level, it's highly unlikely that we're going to do well at any other level as well, because the foundation, if you've been with me as I've described it here, is so critical to the management of your energy and the creation of the flow of your energy, that if you don't have the bottom end right, the foundation, then really all that's going to happen is you're going to find yourself in a perpetual wild goose chase. Unless you've, you know, got really rich parents or somebody that's going to consistently keep bailing you out, getting those first three lessons under your belt and living them is essential. I know I could not have done all the writing and books and videos and audios and you name it. Sometimes when I look at my own resume, it baffles me as to how I got it done. But then when I look at the systems that I've put in place so I can get things done, it makes it obvious that I've lived my lessons. Your fourth lesson is how to write a business plan, where we cover the essentials of writing a business plan. And a business plan is really like a life plan, and a business, in my opinion, is a living organism. So the same way you might write go hire a trainer to write you an exercise program or a diet plan, you're going to need help writing a business plan, because the same way your diet and exercise plan is a plan for supporting life in your body, a business plan is a plan for supporting life in your business. And just the way we eat food and drink water, businesses eat resources and seem to drink money. And hopefully they make some too. And lesson five is money management. It's all about wants versus needs. It's a sad reality that 98% of the U.S. population is one paycheck from bankruptcy right now. The money management lesson is also really, really important, because as I tell my students quite often, the way you do anything is the way you do everything. And there are now studies available that have analyzed people that have won the lottery. And interestingly enough, they found quite a shocking outcome in these studies. The outcome was that 98% of the people that win the lottery worldwide are broke within 1 year. Now, that's pretty interesting. And people ask me, well, how does that happen? And I say, well, think of money like water, and think of money management like containing water, catching it. So if you live out in the, you know, off the grid and you don't have a well, then you've got to put a great big giant funnel on your roof that catches water for you when it rains. So when people have water leaks in the system, or money leaks or energy leaks, then if you put tons of water through a leaky system, you just lose tons of water. If your gas tank had a hole in it, then filling it up with $1 million worth of fuel would just be a $1 million waste. So the money management lesson really looks carefully at what are the basics of money management. And there are lessons in here that you might find just a pain in the ass because you don't enjoy certain things like that. And I'm with you. I understand that. So as I always tell my students, if you're real honest with yourself and there's things you don't like, and you can just be totally upfront with that, then it's one thing to not like them. It's another thing to not do them. And if you're not going to like it, but you need to do it, there's a little thing called delegating. So in cases like that, it's important to go through the lessons anyhow so you know exactly what you need to delegate and be responsible for. I can tell you firsthand that no matter how much backup help you have, there's always some level of need for redundancy in backup systems. James was my redundancy tonight. Without James, I probably would have showed up here and wondered why you guys weren't on the phone in an hour.
Mm-hmm.
So if you study a lesson like writing a business plan or money management or marketing and you just don't think it really is for you, then the whole purpose of studying it is to be sure that you're aware who, what, where, when, why, and how you're going to delegate each of these things, because these 12 lessons are actually relevant to life. They're relevant to all aspects of life. For example, the marketing lesson isn't just about marketing a business. It's about getting clear that you are the business and that to the degree that you care for, love, and respect and manage yourself, you can care for, love, and respect and manage a business or a relationship with somebody else or a relationship with lots of people. A lot of my students, when they get to the higher levels of training, come to me and say they want to teach for me. And so at that time, I make it really clear to them that it's very important to learn how to teach when you're not teaching. And, of course, they look at me funny, and I say, you know, anybody that's your student is going to know they're your student intuitively just by the way you do things, by the way you move, by the way you carry yourself, by your confidence in yourself. You cannot fake being a master. You can only be one or you're not. So I've had many of my instructors do the PPS lessons so that they are aware of not only what it is that they need to focus on, but what their students need to focus on in order to be successful. And the reason that's so important for us as a teacher is because people naturally love to do the things that they're good at. So you get a lot of artists that love to do art, and they're very right brain dominant, but they can't get their left brain to take responsibility for itself, so they're never sure how much money they have in their checking account or whether they've got enough money in the bank or enough coming in to pay the bills. So they go into crisis mode about the 29th day of every month and then have to go flogging art everywhere for 48 hours to keep their boat afloat. So we always have to, you know, work both sides of the reality fence. Lesson 7 was one of my favorite ones to put together because I'm sort of a weirdo when it comes to that, and that's how to learn. Many of us have academic degrees. I'm not one of them. But I became very, very aware that there was a terrible problem in academia when I started traveling around the world lecturing in universities with my ninth grade education. And I found that people that had degrees in fields, advanced degrees in fields that I was knowledgeable in, such as orthopedic rehabilitation, holistic health, you know, biomechanics, etc., had a terribly poor understanding and oftentimes had totally invested their energy in theoretical concepts that really didn't play out in the real world. So having run across many of my students that have told me they got more out of a one-week workshop with me than they did in 4 years in university, I thought I really better share with people a process that does teach you how to learn. So Lesson 7 is all about how to learn. It's about how I learn and principles of learning that I've picked up by studying learning. And I think it's a very important lesson for people to utilize. Lesson 8 is one I proved to you today, time can't be managed. That's the name of that lesson. Only activities can be managed. We all have 24 hours in a day, and no matter what, you'll find yourself wondering where the time goes all the time. So when it comes to the harsh reality that the clock's going to keep ticking whether we like it or not, and whether we're ready for it or not, then we really have to start looking at what we're managing. And what we're managing is activities. And I do a lot of work in the PPS program to help people learn to not over consume themselves with too many activities, because if you do, you start doing a less and less effective job at any one task, goal, or objective, and the next thing you know, you can't figure out why, you know, you don't have any business or things just aren't going right. Lesson 9 is one of the most important lessons because it's such a common problem for people. Lesson 9 is titled, Don't Get Your Feathers Wet, and Don't Get Your Feathers Wet is really all about how to understand that other people's opinions don't need to be your opinion, and that it's okay to be different than other people. It doesn't necessarily mean that you're wrong, there's anything wrong with you, but many of the PPS practitioners will tell you, if you talk to them, that the amount of change that takes place in your life just from the first two lessons alone is so significant that it's not unusual for people that are family, close friends, people that you work with begin to voice their opinions about the changes they perceive in you. And the reality of it is because the mastery program will move you forward in your self-development very, very fast. A lot of the judgments that they make are based on their own fears, because most people themselves are unable to manage their own growth and development, yet they know inside that they're not really becoming something greater. People tend to get easily stagnated in today's society due to all their influences on by the media. People get pacified by the media, and they start living vicariously instead of actually living. So Don't Get Your Feathers Wet teaches you how to manage criticism effectively. Number 10, the Great Polarities, is one that I really think is essential foundation knowledge, and that is understanding how mind works and understanding a lot of the principles that are used, particularly by the Abrahamic religions, to trick you into a fear state so that you're easily programmed and that you remain programmable or controllable. It also shows you why duality consciousness is very, very dangerous and leads to a perceptual reality that is potentially very, very far from the truth of how the universe works. So many of the students have told me they really enjoyed Lesson 10. Lesson 11 is all about communication skills, and my mother and her husband, Alex Sensor, are the mentors for that lesson. I forgot to mention writing a business plan and money management. We were supported by Christine Prakas and my wife, Penny Crozier, who are both business experts on those lessons. My mother and Alex give us a lot of support. There's a nice interview with them there on the website for the practitioners. And I teach you a simple acronym I developed for learning how to communicate effectively with people so that you don't create unnecessary resistance to getting what you want and need. Lesson 12 is a very, very important one. It's listening skills development, and it's all about learning how to hear what people are saying. Lesson 12 is a very, very important adjunct to Lesson 2, because Lesson 2 is all about understanding why people communicate the way they do, even when it looks ridiculous at times. But when you understand what they're really trying to communicate to you through the techniques used in Lesson 12, then everything falls into place. So those are the 12 lessons in brief overview. And those lessons can now be done in any order that you want to, although I really do emphasize the importance of doing at least Lesson 1 and 2 first. Lesson 1, 2, and 3 we call, you know, the foundation principles or the first step. And from there, you're in position to pick and choose based on, you know, wants, desires at this time in your life. The lessons can now be done individually as well. We used to only take people in if they went through the entire 12 lessons in the right sequence. But due to the fact that so many students felt that they needed support from other lessons and were having crisis states, we felt we should open it up and just encourage people to follow the plan correctly. So, James, I think I've, you know, stated what was the essentials about how the PPS plan got started and what an overview of each of the 12 lessons is. If you would like to open the phone lines or if you have any other announcements to make right now, then I'm happy to take some questions.
Well, why don't we, because I know that we have a lot of people on the line and we had a lot of email questions. So I think what we'll do is just we'll turn the lines open and we will let everybody have a chance to ask their questions. Now, before I unmute the lines, I will just remind everybody who's on with us that if you're not asking a question or you're not joining in part of the discussion, what you might do is just mute your own line, and you can do that by pressing *6, and that'll keep the recording kind of clear. So that you know, when other people go to listen to it, it's a nice clean recording. And then if you do have a question, you can unmute your line by pressing any button on your phone pad. So let me unmute the audience. Okay, great. Now if you have a question, what you can do is press any button on your phone pad and you ask away. So let me turn it open. Does anybody have a question for Paul? Just press the button on your phone pad, and you can ask away. And don't be shy. I know Paul can take it.
Yeah, hit me with your best shot. Make it interesting for me. Somebody's got to have a challenge going on out there.
Hey, Paul.
Yes, sir.
This is Danny in New York. How are you?
I'm great, Danny. How are you?
Oh, it's always good to speak with you, Paul.
All right. Well, good. How can I help you?
Well, I listened to some of the old PPS lessons, and for some reason, emptying the bones stuck in my head in shamanism. And
yeah.
Don Miguel Ruiz.
Yeah.
Why did you feel that you were drawn to those particular modalities as opposed to something else in Shinto or Hinduism or something like that?
Well, first of all, my father is half-blooded Cherokee Indian. I'm quarter-blooded. My grandfather was full-blooded Cherokee Indian, so Native American Indian ideology is pretty much buried in my genome, and I just feel very, very at home with that philosophy. I do study Taoism extensively, and it is an important aspect of my own practice, the way I live. As a matter of fact, if I, you know, was asked if I practiced a religion, I would say no, but I would say the closest thing to my personal belief system would be Taoism. So the real issue about emptying the bone more than anything is really getting to the point in your own personal growth and development where you can put your own mind chatter aside and you can be fully present with someone and allow them to express themselves and their wants and their needs and their desires to you without beginning a game of mental tennis prior to them even finishing their sentence or making their point. And also, the term emptying the bone means that we are capable of creating stillness in ourselves and create sacred listening space for the other and for ourselves to truly hear. There's a, you know, if you look at all the world religions, pretty much all of them take you into practices at one time or another that heal the ego enough to be present with somebody else. And paradoxically, it's the people that need to listen most to the people in their lives in order to get an accurate reflection of themselves that have the hardest time listening to other people. So at the end of the day, as long as an individual learns how to manage their mental-emotional reality so that they can effectively interface with other people, then everybody does okay. But when we don't learn to truly hear other people's wants, needs, and desires, then it's very, very easy for us to forget that there's really not much we can do in this world without the support of other people. And, you know, even if you're on your own out in the woods, anybody that studies psychology knows that one of the most challenging things for any human being is being isolated. So when you are alone, you crave people, and when you're around lots of people, you crave being alone, and those two polarities reflect what goes on inside of mind. But when someone learns how to empty the bone, they go beyond needing to be with someone or to be alone. There just becomes a still point at which time they can hear, feel, and intuit the other person's needs. The model that I use for listening is also built on the concept that mind comes in essentially three layers beyond which there is no longer any mind. The first layer of mind is instinctual. And to the degree that a person doesn't take care of themselves, then they can never really free themselves from the instinctual mind, because the instinctual mind is driven by the needs of the body. So to the degree that the body is unhealthy or out of balance, the mind itself also has to be a reflection of that body. Once we go above the instinctual mind, we get to the intellectual mind. And if you go into intellect without first learning how to manage instinct, then you can get yourself into terrible trouble, because a divided instinct produces a divided intellect. Once we learn how to use the intellectual mind correctly, then we go to the level of intuition. Yet intuition is a further step above instinct again. So when somebody starts bringing intuition into a mind field or a field of the body that is unhealthy and out of balance, then you can never really trust your intuitions. They become more like hazy dreams. And then finally, we come to the level of the soul, or the level that is sometimes referred to, or Osho refers to it as union. And that is exactly where we're trying to go when we're emptying the bone. When I'm doing a healing session with a cancer patient or someone that's having a life crisis, my first task, my first intention is to prepare myself adequately so that my needs are met. I've got enough food, enough water. I've got everything taken care of around me. Cell phones shut off. And everything is, you know, at a point where I can disengage from the matter of the world, and I can go into a state of union. And when I'm in a state of union with somebody, that's where my bone is empty, and that's where I cease to exist as anything other than a membrane that senses the vibration that's emanating from that person's aura or reality. And because I've emptied the bone, their reality becomes my reality. So my body becomes an organ that they play energetically, and to the degree that I empty myself out, I can feel what their reality is. So that's really the approach to that lesson, and that's why I built it the way I built it.
Thank you, Paul.
Any other questions?
Yes, my name's Aaron. I'm calling from Florida.
Hello, Aaron from Florida. How can I help you, bud?
Actually, I emailed this question, but I figured I'd just go ahead and ask it. Could you list for me maybe the top 10 books of all time in your mind?
Well, I can certainly give you a crack at it. I don't know if you've ever seen a picture of my library, but for me to list the top 10 books is a lot harder than most people because I've read a lot of books. Right. What are your interests?
My interests are varied, very eclectic. Health, wellness, intellectual theory, literary theory, philosophy, you name it.
Okay. Well, let me see here. A great book for you. Now, I'm not going to give you these in any order because with rare exceptions, like it's really hard for me to do anything but bullshit you by telling you this is number one, this is number two. So I'll just give you some books that I think are worthy of reading for anybody. Ken Wilber has a great book, which you can also get on audio, called A Brief History of Everything. And I probably studied that audio cassette series about 10 times because it was that rich. It was mind-blowingly rich. If you haven't read the book Guns, Germs, and Steel by Jared Diamond, are you familiar with that one?
No, sir.
Okay, Guns, Germs, and Steel by Jared Diamond. I would really recommend tracking down the documentary that was done by National Geographic by the same title, and the author Jared Diamond is the star of the documentary. It's a shocking, mind-blowing exposé of how we got here and how white men just wiped out the natives of most parts of the world and essentially became a plague to the rest of the planet. But it's a very, very important developmental video because it shows you how ideas unfold and can terminate other ideas very, very effectively. Philosophically, my favorite philosopher is Plotinus. Are you familiar with Plotinus?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so if you have not read much Plotinus, I would really, really recommend studying Plotinus because Plotinus was very, very metaphysical. So his philosophy isn't dry, but he came, if I remember, he died around 273 A.D. But many of the ideas that are now woven into Christianity are actually ideas that come from, that were either directly from or modified by Plotinus. And Plotinus's view of life is really, really comprehensive and beautiful because he ties groups of ideas together. For example, the ascenders, which are people that just think that the world is a place you got to get away from and that you just die and go to heaven. The descenders, which I'll call gluttons, who just think that, this is it, this is the end of the line, you just got to use it all up while you can, doesn't matter, you're going to die. And then everything in between. Spinoza is another one of my favorite philosophers because I believe his philosophy on God is extremely accurate, and there's a very excellent book I would also recommend called Jung on God. Are you familiar with Carl Jung?
Yes, I am.
Okay, so there's a great little book that was written by one of his more astute students that have done a lot of, work with him and his work. And that book's called Jung on God. Another one that I have that's very good is Kant on God, K-A-N-T on God. You'll see that I'm recommending a lot of books on God here because in my work with people for 25 years, I have found that ideas about God are the most damaging ideas that can get into somebody's head and the most addiction, probably even far beyond sugar itself, is a God addiction. You read the Tao Te Ching?
Yes, multiple times.
Okay, good. Have you studied the lost teachings of Lao Tzu?
No, I don't believe I have.
Okay. Well, I'm just looking in my library, but like I said, I have a lot of books in here. The Lost Teachings of Lao Tzu, if you just do a search on Google, you'll find that. Highly recommended. It's written by a man whose family studied or was indoctrinated into these teachings throughout their whole lineage. It's called the Unknown Teachings of Lao Tzu. The book's called Hua, H-U-A, next word, capital H-U, Ching, Hua Hu Ching. And the author is Brian Walker. Excellent book. Now, one of my all-time favorite books, like if you wanted to know what book in my library was probably my favorite book, Osho's biography. Osho's biography is a mind-blowing read. It's just, you know. Do you know anything about Osho?
No, I've never heard of him.
Okay, well, you will certainly be delighted when this call is worth it for you then. The book's called Autobiography of a Spiritually Incorrect Mystic. Okay, and his whole name, it used to be Sri Bhagwan Rajneesh, but he changed it years before he died to Osho, O-S-H-O. And this book is excellent. As a matter of fact, you probably won't be able to put it down once you pick it up. Okay, now I've got right here in front of me about 165 books published by Osho. He published over 500 books in his lifetime. He didn't write any of them except the one I just gave you the name of. All of these books are transcriptions of his lectures. If you haven't read my book, How to Eat, Move, and Be Healthy, I'd really recommend that one. Have you read that?
I actually have bought one copy for just about everybody I know.
Okay, well, that's good. Now I know you're a quality human being, so. How many books have I given you so far?
Well, I really don't want to take up too much time, but you've given me a lot, and I thank you very much.
Yeah, there's lots of them. I'll tell you what, you just triggered me. Have you heard of the book, any of the books by Itzhak Bentov?
Yes, I have.
Okay, have you got Stalking the Wild Pendulum?
No.
Okay, so that's an excellent book. That's a beautiful mix of science and metaphysics. And then he's got another one called A Cosmic Book. And then his third one, which his wife finished because he died, is A Brief Tour of Higher Consciousness. Those are excellent for all of you online. Those are absolutely excellent introductory books to what I would call real metaphysics, not religious diatribe. Another excellent book is Cosmic Consciousness by Richard Maurice Buck, B-U-C-K-E. So those are a few. I could go on and on and on. Literally, you know, one of my hobbies is to collect good books. So there's hardly a book in my library that isn't really worth reading. I think of all those books, I would recommend you start with Osho's biography.
I will.
You'd be in for a hell of a good ride, man.
Thank you.
You'll find out how dangerous it is to be honest with people. He got kicked out of 23 countries.
Oh, wow.
And he flew his own jet. He was a very wealthy man. He owned 91 Rolls Royces. And Osho prided himself because he said, I'm the only rich guy I know of that made lots of money that, by not doing anything.
Wow.
So he says that his goal was to teach the Westerners how to use the principle of non-doing to create safety, security, and well-being and wealth. And he did. By every stretch of the imagination, he did it. So I think I'll leave you with those for now.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thanks for your interest. By the way, anything by Rumi or Kabir, I would recommend. Are there any other questions? I think I need you to mute your line now, there, partner.
Hello?
Hello.
Hi, my name is Emma. I'm in Dallas, Texas.
Hi, Emma from Dallas.
Hey, I just wanted to thank you, first of all, for this open house this weekend. It's been really helpful for me. I'm a recovered drug addict 10 years this month.
Wow.
And, I've noticed that you have on the site Overcoming Addictions, and I wanted to ask if you're planning to put some more stuff on your site and put some more things out there for people that are in recovery or know people that want to be in recovery.
Yes, well, I just finished that program. It's a brand new release. It's only been out for a few days now. Mm-hmm. And that program's 10 hours of audio with a workbook. And I think my approach to addiction, eating disorder, and disease is much, much more holistic than anything I've ever seen out there.
See, that's how I recovered. I tried 12-step. I tried a lot of different things. And what finally worked for me through trial and error was a holistic lifestyle and getting active again. And love,
yeah.
Of course. Love was the thing that changed it all.
Well, there's a lot about love right in my program. That's right where we start.
Okay, cool. Well, I just wanted to take a minute and thank you very much for this because it's been very helpful, and you'll be hearing from me soon.
Good. I look forward to sharing with you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Would anyone else like to ask a question?
Hey, Paul, this is Scott.
Yeah, Paul.
Oh, we'll take Scott first, and who's next there? Whose voice did I hear? A woman's voice.
Yes, Melissa from Florida.
All right, Melissa, you're on deck, all right?
Okay, awesome, thanks.
Thanks. Go ahead, Scott.
All right. I actually have it's kind of a two-part question. The first one is the PPS Mastery Success Program the best program to go through if you're dealing with, like, fear and anxiety issues? I have a strong desire to want to do things in public. I sing, but yet, you know, have anxiety, and, you know, when I get around people, obviously I want to build a business around this kind of stuff and do workshops and things of that nature, but, you know, I'm in a place in my life where fear and anxiety kind of, you know, cave me down. So I was just wondering, is this the best program to go through to deal with those issues, or are there other tools you would recommend instead? And then I went through and listened to one of the legacy lessons, and one of the things that you said really startled me, and it said that you said that there's a good chance that in this lifetime a lot of people won't actually find their purpose or their legacy. And that was kind of a scary thing. So what do you say to people that might fall into that category?
I say the same thing to all of them. What's more important than finding your legacy is clearly defining your core values, because your core values determine who and what you are as a person when it comes to relationships with persons, places, or things. If somebody finds their legacy without first establishing core values, then almost always what happens when they start making money, they lose it all. So this is back to the, you know, the one-hit wonder musician who, you know, made a bunch of money but then didn't manage themselves correctly and ended up becoming a drug addict or, you know, falling in love with the wrong woman, et cetera, et cetera, and the show goes on. So the answer to you is yes. Everything you need to learn, see, what you're describing is a problem of mental self-management.
Yeah.
And where there's a problem with mental self-management, there's automatically a problem with emotional self-management. And where there's a problem with mental-emotional self-management, 99.9% of the time, there is some disconnect between how to love and care for your body and how you're currently using your mind. Because as I was saying to one of the earlier questioners, I think it was Danny from New York, that the instinctual mind is really, really embedded within the genome and the cells of the body. So to the degree that the way you eat and the way you live and the way you hydrate or not, to the degree that that is offensive or threatening to your body, it automatically puts your hormonal system out of balance, and it also creates tremendous imbalances of the flow of your thoughts. Whenever the body is in a state of fear or need, it commandeers the mental-emotional structure for the very explicit purpose of trying to trigger you into addressing whatever the need is. Yet when people lose the ability to interpret their instincts correctly, they oftentimes, for example, mistake thirst for hunger and eat instead of drinking. Or they don't know how to interpret the message from their body with regard to what ratio of plant to animal foods they need to eat, so they do what everybody else is doing. And when their energy cycles begin to collapse, they start reaching for sugar and other addictive substances to balance themselves out. So the next thing you know, you have someone who's got a head full of great ideas, but they cannot execute them because their energy is scattered all over the place and their body's constantly in a survival crisis, which creates tremendous imbalances at the hormonal level, which is where you experience emotion as real, and that's where you experience thoughts as real.
Gotcha.
So really, for someone like you, the first three lessons, if you go through those and really be present with them, will give you all the tools that you need to create a foundation, and then I would look at understanding the great polarities. And then I would look at how to communicate and how to listen. And then finally, for you, you would really benefit from don't get your feathers wet, because the more successful you get, the more criticism you'll get. Believe me, I'm an expert on that topic. So if you're not careful and you don't manage yourself correctly, success actually can kill you, because it can be so damaging to your self-esteem if you invest in other people's ideas and don't have the structure, the values, and the skills to differentiate what is constructive versus destructive criticism. You can find yourself, again, a one-hit wonder. So those would be my suggestions for you, and I think that between PPF Lesson 1 and Lesson 2 alone, you will go so far into learning to manage yourself, you won't even remember who you were. It'll literally can seem a lifetime. You can achieve a lifetime's worth of self-growth in those two lessons alone.
Okay, I appreciate it. Thanks, Paul.
I've had people write me letters telling me that if they only did Lesson 1, it was worth the price of the entire course, and this is back when we charged $4,700 for the 12 lessons. Of the initial 90 students that signed up, many of them told me that Lesson 1 was worth the money they spent on the whole program itself. So that's feedback from other people with similar challenges to your own.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Yeah, no problem.
Hello, Paul.
Hello.
Hi, this is Melissa.
Hi, Melissa. How can I help you, dear?
I wanted to ask, what do you do to keep yourself, daily practices that you recommend to keep yourself grounded and clear and focused on what you're committed to?
Well, first and foremost, I make sure I have time for myself.
Mm-hmm.
That's where everyone goes wrong. Everyone's got a list of all the things they've got to do every day for everybody but them. So most of my patients show up here totally burned out and exhausted, unhappy, no sex drive, pocket full of drugs, a disease, addictions. I want to sit down and start sharing with them the things they need to do for themselves. Guess what they always do?
What? They don't do it.
They tell me they don't have time.
Oh.
I don't have time. I don't have time to exercise. I don't have time for spiritual practice. I don't have time to go to the store and get organic food. Oh, not water. It tastes, I hate water. It doesn't have any taste to it. Good. Sounds to me like you're having a hell of a good time, because so far, you're not interested in doing any of the things that you've absolutely got to do to get yourself healthy. A big part of the problem is that, unfortunately, the Abrahamic religions all teach us to give ourselves away in service to others. They give us some very false ideas about the truth of how life works. And these religions are designed to do that because it keeps you in need of the church. They create codependency. My system is designed to create self-competence, self-sufficiency. So my day unfolds by me usually getting up at about 6 o'clock a.m. every day, I shower and grab my food for the day, head into work, turn on my beautiful handmade Italian espresso machine, and turn on my computer, and then I sit, and some mornings I'll write an article. Other mornings I'll study spiritual writings, such as Rumi or Kabir or Hazrat Inayat Khan. By the way, the young man that asked me about the books, I'm going to throw one more out for him, hit my mind. Volume 8 of Hazrat Inayat Khan's series. And then I go to work, usually by about 8, and I start writing and returning emails and writing articles and revising manuals and updating slideshows and lectures, and you know, it's an endless stream of stuff they've got for Paul Check to do every day, believe me. At 10 o'clock I go to the gym and I study Osho while I train every day. So on my headphones I'm taking Osho's lectures. I've got about 300-400 hours of lectures that were recorded by the Osho Foundation. And while I'm training, I keep two notebooks handy, one where I keep my notes from Osho and the other one which I call general notes. And as I'm studying anything, I always have a general notebook in which I write down ways in which I can use any new idea that I've acquired through my morning spiritual practice or studies of Osho's work in my teachings, in my life, and to help other people in any possible way. Then I come back and I have lunch, and after lunch I often see a patient. Sometimes I'll see a patient between working out and lunch, depending on what's going on. And then if I see a patient, that usually lasts for several hours, so I only usually see one patient in a day. Otherwise, I have meetings and teleconferences and all sorts of things. I do that till dinner. If I get a little sluggish in the afternoon, I'll go outside and do some Tai Chi or some Qigong out in the sun by the tree. And I typically try to get myself out of here by about 7:30. I like to be home by 8 o'clock at night. When I get home, my normal practice as I do a mandala or some kind of a piece of art. And I find that whenever I need to just download and de-stress myself, that being creative with my artwork has a very, very healing effect on me. And I used to work 7 days a week, literally round the clock, and I did that for about 24 years. And in the last year, I've found that in order for me to have the energy I need to be present with people and feel motivated to do the work that I do, because a lot of the work I've been doing for so many years, it can get quite boring, you know?
Yeah.
Like, you know, I've been coaching people for 25 years, so when I have to stand there and tell people about gluten intolerance for the 9 millionth time or how to do a horse dance exercise for the 27 millionth time, it's a bit like having my panty line waxed repeatedly or something. So I have to do things for myself now to feel nourished enough to be present with other people. So I've been taking as many Fridays off as I can, and I've been taking the weekends completely off now for, the better part of a year. And thank Vidya for that, my assistant. She's straightening me out that way, getting me to hold still and be a better boy on Monday. So that's pretty much how I look, you know. I pretty much have a very consistent system I built for myself, where I make sure I have Paul time, I have spiritual practice, I have great nutrition in place, I have, you know, a Paul Check designed exercise program that seems to work pretty good. If you look on the internet, you can see for yourself.
Yeah, my friends actually introduced me to your work, and ever since I've really looking into this and other spiritual things and reading Osho's book, Being in Love, my mind is just going, wow, like everything, it's challenging a lot of things that I've thought. And then I'm coming around the people in my life, and sometimes I can't even be around some people because I'm just like, they're so draining. And so it's like when they're like, what you do, because I'm like at this vibrational level of just really like focused, and, you know, and then I get around some people and I'm like, oh, get me home.
Yeah. Well, you'll see if you study the love model that I teach in the program, the 1-2-3-4 for overcoming addiction, obesity, and disease. I teach a 4-stage love model, and the first stage that we all emerge in is sex and violence living. And unfortunately, most of us were raised in families where our parents used sex and violence love as a means of expressing themselves to us and instilling their principles in us. But once you rise up to the next level of love, which is conditional love, or the third and highest level for a human being, which is empathetic and compassionate love, until you get to empathetic and compassionate love, you can find that people can be extremely draining. And even when you're there, the first person you have to have empathy and compassion for is yourself.
Yeah.
Because even the Dalai Lama gets tired of the flies, so to speak. And I've studied his work quite a bit, and I've got a number of documentaries, and one of the things that's very clear in some of his documentaries is that the Dalai Lama will not even meet with somebody unless he has clear indications that, A, they're novel, B, they're doing something to help other people, and C, they're not just going to be a pain in the ass. And in one of my documentaries, they interview his assistant, and he says, when the Dalai Lama is meeting with someone who starts to become criticismal, dogmatic, or non-productive, they said he just bows, stands up, and walks out of the room, and that's it, meeting over. And he said, sometimes that can happen in, you know, 1 minute. Other times, people will last for 10, 20 minutes. But the process you're describing is a natural one, and the thing is that as I show you in my 1-2-3-4 for overcoming addiction, obesity, and disease, we become disciplined with ourselves, because the first person you truly have to love and manage is yourself, because no matter whether we like it or not,
we bring at least 50% to every relationship. And if you come into a relationship tired, irritated, frustrated, and sick of people, then that's exactly what you bring into the relationship. So the byproduct of any relationship that has that in it is just tired and frustrated and sick of people, paradoxically. So
I'm noticing like a lot of like out. I feel like I'm outgrowing a lot of people in my life.
But it takes a lot of strength within to leave those people behind.
Yeah.
And you'll find that if those people get the idea in their head that they're falling behind you, then the reptilian nature of human personality will come out, and they will start criticizing you or downplaying your own motive, your own drive, and your own success as a means of bolstering their own inability to take responsibility for themselves. And this is why I told the other young man, lesson 9, don't get your feathers wet, is really important, because if you start becoming successful at anything, you've got to learn how to separate constructive from destructive criticism and know how to manage it, or it'll just eat you alive.
Okay.
So I was just going to say lesson 1, lesson 2, and the 1-2-3-4 program would be very, very supportive of your objectives.
Okay. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Pleasure to share with you.
Yeah, when I was watching your videos, it was like, oh, it's nice to hear other people that are doing this work.
Yeah.
It makes you not feel like you're going crazy.
Yeah, well, you know, I tell the truth at all. You know, I'm not here to bullshit people or make friends. I'm just here to let them know how to do it. I've been here many, many times before, so I feel like I'm walking around in a daycare center most of the time, but that's okay.
Well, thank you for your service.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you. I need your help. Would anyone else like to ask a question?
And I'll just remind everybody that if you have a question, you can unmute your line by pressing any button on your phone pad.
You want to ask a...
Yeah, you want to do some email questions?
Yeah, why don't you go for it with me there? I got them printed out, but it sounds better to me when you read them.
Well, I'm happy to read them. Let's start with a question from Jules. And Jules writes in, I'm consciously taking ownership of my life and all my choices thus far, and there is one particular area I am really trying to master. I feel very tested by the universe at trusting that I can be financially abundant. Each day, I remind myself that the universe will always meet me at my game of or whether or not I'll be financially abundant, and I change my thoughts and vocabulary to reflect what it is that I want to be my truth. So I feel like I'm making steps towards not being financially stressed on the physical plane as well as the inner, but I would love any guidance that you could offer me on this. Thank you, Paul.
Well, here's the deal. Jules is right where a lot of people get to and give up. They give up hope because they do everything that's been taught to them in a program like mine or Brian Tracy's or Zig Ziglar's, Bob Proctor's or whoever's, and they still find themselves facing a financial challenge. And it can be, you know, emotionally disturbing when you've really done your best to subscribe to principles and philosophies that are taught by people who are reliable and successful themselves. The reality of it is we must remember that each human life is like a leaf on a tree. And one leaf on a tree can take all the courses it wants about tree abundance, about how to farm, about how to produce fruit. But the reality of it is that that leaf
is the child of that branch, which is the child of the trunk, which is equally dependent upon the root system and the sun and the weather system to bring rain. And so no matter how we slice it, there are energetic tides, there are flows that move through relationships, through tribes, through societies, through families, and this is all very well borne out in astrology. Really, astrology is a science that tells you how the universe and its life is influencing your universe and your life. So my advice for anybody who is doing their best to put the pieces together but doesn't seem to be getting the right return would be to hire a good astrologer. There's going to be an interview coming up on the PPS website soon with Susan McNaughton, who's an excellent Vedic astrologer and is very good at personalizing a reading to what's relevant to you, the individual. Now, I'm not someone that reads the, you know, horoscopes and things like that, but I have used medical astrology and Vedic astrology and even Western astrology when I'm working with clients that seem to be blocked against all the odds. In other words, they're doing everything they should be doing, but things still aren't moving. And in pretty much every case where I've had to investigate with an astrologer, lo and behold, in their own language, they told me exactly why the person was blocked. The other thing is we've got to remember that we have karmic relationships with other people, places, and things. And while our consciousness may be, you know, working on creating wealth or abundance, if for any reason that our production of wealth or abundance will change the outcome of our soul contracts such that we do not fulfill soul contracts, then you will find that no amount of work that you can do is more effective than the work of your own soul. So oftentimes what I do with people that are doing all the work but they're not acquiring abundance is I start looking carefully at their relationships with other people, places, and things to find out whether or not there's relationship lessons that need to be learned in order to essentially cut the bonds of entanglement. For example, if you're working very hard at creating abundance consciousness, but your mother, your brothers, and your sisters are very good at creating poverty consciousness, then you can find that there's such a deficit in the very roots of you that you've got to heal yourself from your relationship with your family. And this really happens a lot in PPS Lesson 2, because you really come to clearly see where the ideas in your head are your own and where they're your family's or your parents'. And when somebody's in a crisis of abundance, oftentimes what they'll see is that they were programmed into it, and every time they get around their family without realizing what's happening, and they're being reprogrammed and recalibrated to not be abundant but to have lack consciousness. So, Jules, I understand the challenge that you're describing. It's common. And with a person like you, I prefer to teach them how to understand the Tao Te Ching. The reality of it is you probably have more abundance in your life than you've actually taken account of. And therefore, I oftentimes find people that really do have a beautiful, fulfilling, nourishing, well-rounded life are perpetually looking for more with the assumption that having more is going to make things better. So I do a program called Zero Force Coaching where people hire me for 20 hours of private training to help them accomplish whatever it is that they would like to accomplish. And oftentimes I get people into the Tao Te Ching so they can learn to understand it, because as Osho said, there is no religion before Lao Tzu, and there is no religion after Lao Tzu. And what he means is, if you understand the 81 verses of poetry in the Tao Te Ching, there is no need to study metaphysics or be part of a religion anymore, because you have been given what you need to know to navigate life. So I hope that helps, Jules.
Great. Now, before we continue, I'll just ask if anybody who's on the line with us has any questions that they would like to ask. All right, well, let's continue with some more email questions. This question is from David, and David asks, why is it so much easier for people, including myself sometimes, to feel compassion for others, but rarely, if ever, do they feel compassion for themselves?
Well, that goes right back to what I said earlier. Empathy and compassion is a very, very high form of love. It is the highest form of human love. Yet to have empathy and compassion for yourself, you first must move through the stage of sex and violence loving, and then conditional loving. Otherwise, you don't know how to be empathetic and compassionate. The word empathy means to feel somebody else's pain, or truly feel your own. The word compassion means to understand another person's predicament, or your own. You can only have empathy and compassion to the degree that you have experience in life. Empathy and compassion are verbs. They're active words. So until you're actually in the process of being empathetic, it's only an idea. Just because somebody told you that they just found out they got cancer and they might have to have their breast removed, and you walked away going, "Well, that's really the shits. I'm glad it was her, not me," that's not empathy or compassion. That's just fear speaking to itself. You can only have empathy when you've lived through enough pain of your own to really understand what it means when someone says they're going through a divorce, or they're, you know, having chemotherapy, or they've just been through a bankruptcy. Somebody who has minimal experience at life will have an equally minimal range of empathetic and compassionate experiences with which to be authentic. Many people are good at creating conditions. It's necessary to create conditions to get yourself out of sex and violence loving. You have to identify, first and foremost, what your core values are and what you want, and then you've got to develop core values or conditions that lead you in exactly that direction. Sex and violence lovers are usually people that have to be violent or verbally intrusive or abusive in order to get what they want. And the reason they have to be that way is because the parents are so consumed with doing what they want to do, or what they think they're supposed to be doing because they were too also programmed, that they don't have time to listen to you, be fully present with you. So it is much more normal for us today to use sex and violence love on ourselves, because it's the very model we had to use to get the love and support of the people that we need it from the most, which is our family. So you're going to have a very hard time giving yourself empathy and compassion until you learn how to do it. My advice for giving yourself empathy and compassion is to do PBS Success Mastery Lesson 1 and 2, so that you can come to a point of recognizing, first, where you were caught in sex and violence, second, the conditions you've created for yourself, and third, now when you look at your life mandala, you look at your core values, your I, we, your all values, and then you study the values tree, or the values memes
organization, you can then look and see why people communicate the way they do when they're trapped in a sex and violence model. You can see where the conditional people are and what defines them, and you can also identify who the empathetic and compassionate people are and what defines them. And once you've identified people at every stage of the love model, then you can begin to emulate the people whose ideology and whose spirituality most suits what you'd like to become. Remember, the Abrahamic religions all teach us essentially that we crucify ourselves to get to heaven. We must crucify, kill the ego. So these religious undertones create a real need for, almost an addiction to, self-trauma and self-ignorance and self-neglect. And all you've got to do to prove that to yourself is go sit in any parking lot at any temple, mosque, synagogue, or church, and you just watch the people as they get out of their cars and come in, and you'll see a huge percent of them are very unhealthy, obese, and diseased. Yet, they'll take time to go ask God to love them, and they won't take time to love themselves. The very fact that they're in the condition they're in is because they themselves are an expression of the sex and violence loving they were raised with. Until we can recognize that we're using sex and violence love, or ineffectively using conditional love on ourselves, we're not going to love ourselves enough to change. The very act of improving yourself is your first sign of empathy and compassion. So I hope that clarifies that a little bit for you.
I think it does. And before we move on, I'll remind everybody who's on the line that you can unmute your phone line by pressing the unmute button on your phone pad. So if there is anybody who's with us right now and they have you have a question for Paul, don't hesitate to fire away.
Hi, this is LaShawn in New York.
Hi, LaShawn.
Hi. I'd love to hear you talk a little bit more about parenting. You've made quite a few references to it, and also in the 1-2-3 for addiction. But I'm a mother of a toddler and an infant, and in the point where I'm making changes in my life so that I can be a better person and fulfill my legacy and move on. But I also want to do things right for them, so I'd love to hear you talk a little bit more about the unconditional love.
Well, unconditional love cannot be given to a human being. And that's a fact by the nature of the fact that we are human beings. To give unconditional love means to give love without creating a condition. The very act of giving love creates a condition. Because if you're giving love, it means a moment ago you weren't giving it.
Right.
So unconditional love is essentially another way of saying God. And only God can be everything and no thing at one and the same time. God is life. Osho said there's no such thing as God, only godliness. Empathy and compassion is godliness. It is human beings acting towards each other in a way that is most loving and most respectful and most considerate of not only the other person's needs, but of your own. And to be an effective parent means to balance the needs of others with the needs of your own. But it's very, very common for parents to run themselves into the ground, live a life of financial stress and poverty because they think they're doing everything for their kids, so all their money is being pumped into other things for kids. Yet any time you get on an airplane, they tell you right when you begin the flight,
if there's a pressure fluctuation and the masks fall down, what are you supposed to do? Put yours on first or your kids?
Yours.
And why is that?
Because you need to care for yourself before you can care for them.
Right. Because the last thing you want is a dead parent with a bunch of kids running around in an airplane that's about to crash. So, paradoxically, the Abrahamic religions have passed their poison right into our parenting, and the Industrial Revolution took it even a step further, and they created school systems that are actually not really designed to teach you anything except one thing, and that's how to follow orders
mm-hmm.
and to conform. Those are not systems of education. They are babysitting systems, and they used to pacify the children at least 12 hours a day, and the entire modern school system was set up as a means of keeping the parents at work longer and longer and programming the children early when their minds were open. The first 12 years are the most critical. There's a saying in Christianity, pastors often say, if you give me a child, I'll give you a Christian. And what they mean by that is, if they can just get a child to spend enough time in Sunday school, even 1 year can start a virus in the child's mind that it can never free itself from. So the person, most of the people that see me with diseases are sick religious people that are frustrated and confused that God would let them get a disease. So, one of the most important things I can offer you as a parent is to look at the work of Joseph Chilton Pierce. If you go on Amazon and type in his name and set it up so it searches DVDs,
okay.
He's got a couple of excellent videos out there that are all about parenting. One of them's called What Children Want. Or actually, that's another documentary, but he's in it. It's called What Children Want. Joseph Chilton Pierce is an expert on how the brain works and on education. And you will learn a tremendous amount. If you do a search on Google for a book called Raising the Human Plant by Luther Burbank, it was published around 1900. It's one of the best books I've ever read on how to raise children.
Thank you.
And you can find it and just download it for free. It's out of copy right now. And the next thing that I would recommend highly is that you track down the nearest Waldorf school.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Waldorf is Steiner's school system. And Rudolf Steiner was a genius and is considered by many to have been a prophet.
Right, I believe that.
And I also believe that. I'm standing in front of about 160 of Rudolf Steiner's books, which I've been studying for many years. He has got some excellent books on how to raise and take care of children and how to educate them. I would recommend a book right here, Rudolf Steiner on Education by Roy Wilkinson. There's another one by Steiner himself called Education of the Child.
Mm-hmm. Got it.
Yeah, so those are a couple of excellent resources for you.
Thank you.
Okay. Did I answer all your question there?
You did. Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks for joining us. Are there any other questions? James, would you like another email question? You there, James?
Yes, I realized I muted my line and I was reading the question and nobody was hearing it.
So let's do a question from Craig. And Craig writes in, I understand that meditation in its many forms is the understated cornerstone of health, well-being, and achievement, but I often get stuck deciding exactly how my meditation should take its form each day, lying or sitting, guided or unguided, with or without movement or mantra, focus on nothing or focus on something. It can be difficult to choose exactly which form works best for me. How should I decide which form of meditation technique to continue with, or is it like exercise where a change in stimulus, technique, or tempo results in a stronger all-around spiritual body? Which forms are your preferred methods, and how do you choose which to do each day? Do you have any recommendations that might make my meditation experience more valuable?
Who is the person asking the question?
Craig.
Well, Craig, good question. Your initial premise there, I would say, is skewed. Could you read the first part of this question where he wrote about the hallmarks of meditation?
He said that, I understand that meditation in its many forms is the understated cornerstone of health, well-being, and achievement. But he says he gets stuck deciding on exactly how his meditation should take its form.
Yeah. So the problem in there is that it's not the understated cornerstone, because what most people call meditation isn't meditation. It's thinking. And he's demonstrated that right to us in his question. He's trapped in thinking about how he's going to meditate, what type of meditation. And that is exactly what you see in most people. You cannot use doing to create non-doing. The whole function of meditation, the word meditation means concentration. It means to go toward the center. I don't think there was a better meditation teacher than Osho. That was really what he was, and he had over 500,000 followers at the time of his death. And I'd say that's pretty potent, considering that when Jesus died, he only had about 500 followers. So, first and foremost, remember that the word meditation is equivalent of concentration, which means concentrate, toward the center. Meditation is not a doing, it's a non-doing. This is why Osho teaches meditation as witnessing, just watching. There is nothing to do. Zen Buddhists have a little saying, I can't remember the words they use, but the saying translates to no big deal, and it relates to meditation. Many of the Zen masters talk about, you know, how silly it is to go through all these, you know, head-banging meditation rituals, because meditation is something that you're doing all the time, whether you know it or not. Just like your heart's beating and you're breathing all the time, but a lot of people just don't pay any attention to it, so they just forget about it until it starts to hurt, then they look into it. So first and foremost, the best way to choose a meditation technique is to do the one that seems to be the least effort. Because if you work at meditation, you're not meditating, you're thinking, quite simply, as I said earlier. Next, I personally try to be in a meditative state all the time. And what I mean by that is I try to be in the witness position. And life gives us thousands of opportunities to meditate every day. For example, James, when you called me and I was late for this call, it was a bit of a shock to me because I got my wires crossed. So I had a great opportunity there. I could really get pissed off at myself and criticize myself for being late to a PPS open house call. Or I could take the witness position and say, well, you know, is it anything that I did wrong? No. Is it causing any harm? No, not really. Can you make it an opportunity to have some empathy and compassion for yourself and not worry about it? Sure. So what happens is I just allow myself to rise above the issue at hand as opposed to becoming entangled with it. Anybody that does a PPS Success Mastery program, particularly when they go through lesson two, will find that they're highly entangled with other people. And one of the most important things that we can do as meditation is to not force a disentanglement, but to watch and see how other people entangle us and how we, in turn, entangle them. When we say to someone, you better do this or else, I love you but, or I really love it when you do such and such, implying that when you don't do such and such that I'm not loving you very much, all of these things entangle us and pull us out of our center, and they make the relationship more real than we are. So your reality depends on how well you're getting along with your girlfriend or your boyfriend. That's an entangled mind. Real meditation begins as soon as you start witnessing yourself trying to figure out which meditation you should do. Say, oh, look at the little mind of me trying to give itself meaning by making me choose to have to do something. Well, the reality of it is, the instant that you are doing anything other than witnessing, you're entangled, and therefore you're not meditating, because entanglement takes you out of your center and into your periphery. You can't be entangled with someone at the core of yourself. You can only become that person. The core of yourself meaning the soul. If you would like to learn some meditation techniques that I've put together and learned in other places that I use myself, because they allow me to meditate without feeling like I'm forcing it, you can listen to the audio companions that I produced for Dr. Quiet, which is in the Four Doctors section. I think it's available in the audio section. And in there I give, I believe, 7 meditation techniques that are particularly good for active minds. So that's my position on meditation, but my philosophy is that I try to witness my thinking and my use of self as often as I can, and whenever something challenging occurs, a patient's not happy with their billing, or their products didn't get shipped on time, or we've got someone who never showed up for work because they were sick, and now we need an emergency fill, and all these kinds of things that happen. Before I start letting myself get too fly off the handle, I say, okay, here's a situation, you know, where there's some energy moving, so I'm going to have to witness myself so that I don't get too entangled in it. So paradoxically, the very things that give people the hardest time meditating, I believe, are the greatest opportunities to meditate, because in my mind, to meditate is to witness the mind, because to the degree that you can witness the mind loses its control over you. If you're the watcher, you're entangled. So when you're watching a bunch of guys hanging around a television watching a football game, and they start yelling and screaming and shouting obscenities and tossing beer bottles and getting all pissed off, that's entanglement. When people stand around all day talking about soap operas like they're real, or reality TV shows like they're real, this is entanglement. So when we become entangled in a debate with how we're going to do this meditation or that meditation technique, boy, I really don't feel like doing my Tai Chi today, but, you know, I got to be disciplined. Well, then now you're entangled, so you're not meditating. So paradoxically, meditating is the hardest, easiest thing you'll ever do. Enjoy.
Well, great. You know, I think what we should do is give anybody who's on the line, you know, last chance, and then maybe we should wrap it up. What do you think?
Sounds like the right time to do it.
Hello, Paul.
Yes.
Hi, this is Melissa again from Florida.
Hi, Melissa from Florida again.
I have a question that just came up. I hear a lot about some of the things I've read about the accentuation of the new earth or something in 2012. Do you know exactly what that means? Like, have you heard about that?
Yeah, do you know what the term head fuck means?
No.
It means that if you read too many books, you're going to be fucked in the head. Because you'll have so many ideas that you can't manage that you'll forget all about the most important one, which is managing your own life and creating what you want. So, you know, look at all the end of days prophecies from the Old Testament. Look at all the end of days prophecies by evangelical Christians. You know, if you were to come through my library here and sit down and let me stack up all the books that have end of days prophecies, you'd probably walk out of here with your knickers in a knot, scared to death to do anything. Fear that life itself was coming to an end. All that stuff is right there with going to a good movie, but the reality of it is, what percentage of people are already dead because they're not living and loving right now?
Yeah.
Right? So when people ask me, what do you think about 2012? What should I do to prepare? I say, prepare to die. And they look at me like I'm nuts. Well, what do you mean? I say, the best way to prepare to die is to really, truly live. And that's what I teach my students, how to quit playing stupid games, get caught in bullshit, and quit head-fucking themselves constantly. And just learn how to be a witness when you need to witness, be present when you need to be present. When you're making love, be really there. Have you ever had sex with someone who wasn't there?
Yeah, that's not fun.
Not fun, is it? Right?
It's like masturbating
with someone else's body.
Yeah.
Well, most people are just jerking off with life. They're not living it. They're not doing it. They're half-assing everything, and they've got their head so full of end-of-days prophecies that they're basically end-of-daying themselves every minute.
Yeah.
My philosophy is, those types of books belong on a coffee table for sad sacks to sit around and fortify the pathology that they already nourish so well. I have lived fully. In 47 years of life, I have probably done 2 times as much as most people ever did in a lifetime. And if God takes me out of here at any moment, the joke's on God, because I don't care. I've already done my work. I've been honest, I've been loving, I've been truthful. I don't wear a bunch of silly masks to try to be someone special for other people. And that's living. Most people have never yet lived, so the thought of death at any time scares the hell out of them. But you'll know when you've truly lived. When you've truly had good sex, you'll be ready to die. You will literally lay in that bed and go, my God, I don't think I'm ever going to go better than that. If a lightning bolt comes out of the sky and takes me right now, it'll be just perfect, because I'm in such a state of bliss that I can't even imagine life being better than this. Well, I've been there more times than I can bloody count, and I keep waiting for God to come get me, but I think God wants me to have more sex, or I'd be gone by now. Right? That's living.
Yeah.
You know, if somebody has a love affair with a cigarette or a bottle of booze or some recreational drugs, shit, if they're not asking for help, there's nothing we can do. I think that's living. We came here to do this stuff. The problem is everybody goes out, has a good time, parties, and then, you know, goes to church on Sunday and asks for forgiveness for doing what they came here to do in the first place because their heads are all screwed up. The reality of it is, life is a process by which you have an opportunity to become present with the love and the beauty that creates and moves all things. And to the degree that you're focusing on the end of the process of life, you cannot be aware of life itself. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, it does. My thing was that I'm not focused on the end, but I didn't understand what that meant. So when they say this new level of consciousness, and I guess it's just being more aware and present. Like that's where we're going into.
Well, what's happening is we're changing locations within the realm of what are called fixed constellations or the constellations of the zodiac. So our position, the solar system's position and the position of the Earth with regard to the galaxy itself, the Milky Way, the Earth is moving at 68,000 miles an hour. I don't know if you know that, but we're in flight. We're like a bunch of people on a giant airplane.
Isn't it supposed to be going faster or something to another dimension?
Well, there's all sorts of theories. There's theories that we're going to have a dimensional shift, that we're going to be coming into different time-space domains. I mean, there's many, many books out there on it. This is why I say if you study enough about it, then you'll find all the greatest people in the world with PhDs that don't say the same thing twice. Nobody agrees with anybody else.
Yeah.
And if you read, I've got books in my library here which are prophecies of Native American and primitive tribes from all over the world, and they all say similar things, and they all say different things. So at the end of the day, if you're a Hopi Indian, then you're probably going to believe Hopi prophecy. If you're an Eskimo, you're going to believe, philosophy from that region of the world. The energy field, the magnetic field of the Earth is weakening. And the magnetic field of the Earth weakens anytime there's about to be a pole shift. So when there's a pole shift, the polarity of the Earth flips over. So the North Pole essentially becomes the South Pole, the South Pole becomes the North Pole, and that begins another era of about, if I remember right, about 10,000 years. And there's an ice age that usually comes approximately every 10,000 years or so. So a lot of the changes that we're going through right now with the greenhouse effect and a lot of these things, many of them are also part of a cycle that was already in place, and it's very well demonstrated in the ice core records. So how much of it is responsible by our responsibility is undetermined. I would say that what we've done is just accelerated a natural process by denaturing the Earth and nature such that the systems are actually aging more quickly than is normal. It's really hard to say what's coming, but I've been alive long enough to see all sorts of end-of-days prophecies, everything from the millennia to television predictions to you name it, and so far none of them have been true. So my question is just live, my dear.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure. Hello.
Hey, Paul.
Yeah.
This is Roland from Dallas, Texas.
Hey, Roland.
How you doing?
Probably better than most. Got some fresh cornbread waiting for me here.
Good man. Well, quick question about myself personally. I'm sure other practitioners have come across the same question. Why is it relatively more difficult for me personally to work with somebody close to me, like a family member? You get emotionally a little quicker fired up if you're suggesting something and they're not exactly following through, versus dealing with a complete stranger in that case.
The reason for that is because those people's sense of identity or self flowered out of the same source material as your own. So your brothers and your sisters, for example, all emerge typically from the same parents. So what you'll see is that all human beings first seek to identify themselves. That's a process that usually starts beginning at the time the child first emits the word I. That process of individuation typically on a normal, healthy person continues its developmental stages
until the individual reaches 21 years of age. Then the ego is properly formed, if someone's educated properly. When you're dealing with family members, you're dealing with somebody who has an identity so close to your own that to the degree that they follow your advice, isn't it likely that they're going to perceive that they're becoming you?
I guess so.
Right? Even if it's not conscious at the subconscious level,
right,
what you'll see is that to the degree that you become their doctor, their therapist, or their coach, they're ultimately emulating you because you are part of their own family. To the degree that they emulate you, it's kind of like emulating their parents, and that means that they have not differentiated self from other. It's much easier to accept coaching or support from somebody who's highly different than you in racial, ethnic, and genetic origin because there's distance between you, and you don't have to be reminded repeatedly by your subconscious that you're supposed to be equal to or better than that sibling that just taught you how to take care of yourself. So whenever somebody is in a competitive mind state or the ego is malnourished, to the degree that anybody's advice helps heal the ego resists the advice. Because if the individual doesn't do it themselves, doesn't make it their own idea, doesn't take ownership of it, then the ego always feels as though it's being manipulated by an outside source, and it defends itself against that, because to the degree that an outside source changes your behavior, the ego perceives that it's losing its sense of self. So in family members, the defense mechanism is very, very strong, because essentially, if you're teaching them things that they should know, it means you're more intelligent and more capable than they are, and since they're from the same source material, the ego interprets that as a criticism and as a measurement and as a judgment as to its lack of effectiveness, authenticity, quality, goodness, and whatever game it might want to play. Does that clarify that for you?
Yeah. To some extent, that absolutely relates to family members. I also find with the seemingly complete strangers, not what we perceive as relatives, will be the similar case. So I guess that's the goes back to the same point you just mentioned. It's just a protective mechanism due to the fact that they recognize something that is going on in them that has not been resolved yet.
Right, and to the degree that the ego feels threatened because its identity is made up of the pathology they've come to seek help from you for, then the ego is going to try to sabotage. This is why in the Mastery Program, one of the first things we do is a life mandala, so we can look and see how the ego was constructed. And then once we do the life mandala, we establish core values. A big part of what you're describing is trying to coach people without first establishing core values, because your coaching is based on your own core values, not theirs. So if you're using your core values to guide somebody else, to the degree that they follow you without establishing their own core values, they lose themselves in you. And even though they're paying you to coach them, they will resist the change. So I found out years ago that what I had to do is I had to establish core values with people and get them clear on whether or not they did or didn't have a legacy, and if they didn't, how to live their core values as a means of attracting a legacy. And then all my coaching is geared towards helping them achieve their dreams. So it's not that you're going to look and feel better if you lose 40 pounds. It's that if you lose 40 pounds, it's going to make it easier for you to achieve your legacy in the following ways. And then I list them. Not if you don't quit eating sugar, you're going to get a disease. Who gives a shit? Everybody's got one. Today, if you don't have a disease, then you stick out like a sore thumb. It's, let me explain to you how sugar is not going to get you to your goals, your dreams, and your desires optimally relative to eating natural sources of sweetness. So where I sense that you're trying to correct people through your work. I'm trying to facilitate their own dreams, and there's a big difference. Because when I'm working to help someone find their own dream, I'm not telling them what to do. I'm just basically giving them ideas on how to do what they themselves have stated that they want to do. And to the degree that I let them take ownership of those changes as a necessary product of their own self-development, then they embody those changes and they never feel like that they have to protect themselves against me.
That's beautiful. Thank you.
Thank you. So the real secret there is to get through the first step, lesson 1, 2, and 3, and that will anchor you in all the technologies that you need in order to have a better understanding of how to coach people and how to recognize what language they need. PPF lesson 2 teaches you how to restructure your language so that the individual you're speaking to can hear you because you're speaking in the same value system that they operate out of.
Thanks, Paul.
You're welcome.
It doesn't come out like that. It's like, should I go to the doctor, or like, should I do this, or should I do that?
Should we call it a quit? Call it an evening?
I think that's a pretty good place to wrap it up, Paul.
Yeah, all right. Well, listen, I'm going to good night, and thank you all for joining, and I hope you enjoyed your 3 days of PPS Success Mastery, and I hope some of you want to join our community. We have a weekly coaching call like this every week, runs just like this one, and I'm here to help you get through those lessons and answer all your questions and give you the best leadership I can muster.
Yeah, so, well, I was going to say this was just a really wonderful example of how our weekly coaching calls run, and you know, if these really resonated with those of you who are on the line, that this is what it's like every week. So,
James, did you already tell them about the different membership packages?
Well, I was just going to talk a bit about that. You know, we've got a number of different membership packages, and if you really want to get just the initial sampling of the program, what I recommend is what we call the First Step Program, which is the first lesson. All of the slideshows, all of the manual chapters, all of the first lesson materials, but it also includes our DVD set as well, How to Find and Live Your Legacy, which was a kind of compilation of the best sort of bits from our How to Find and Live Your Legacy workshop, live workshop, and that's just, it's a fantastic introduction to the PPS program for $500, $497. And then we also have our Constellation program, which is really a month-by-month subscription to these coaching calls. So it's a automatically renewing subscription for $97. And then you can also buy individual lessons. So if you are at a particular point in your life where, for example, you're just about to start a business and you need to learn how to write a business plan, then our business plan lesson might be just the thing for you. And we have our Life Solutions program that offers a la carte lessons. And then we run all the way up to our PPS Success Unlimited program, which for $4,700 gives you lifetime access to all of our lessons, all of the slideshows, all of the manuals, extra forms, and our weekly coaching calls. So there's really, we have kind of a way of structuring the program that you can tailor to your needs where you are in your life and in your legacy right now. So I encourage everybody to have a look at our different programs. You can go to our homepage and then click on the products and programs link, and that'll take you right to a listing of our various programs and all their offerings.
Sounds good. Sign me up.
I think you're already signed up, Paul. You're signed up for every week.
I got the lifetime membership, didn't I?
You did, both of us.
All right.
Yeah.
At least I know I've got a partner in crime. We're a three-legged race. I can't go anywhere without you.
Likewise. So I will just let everybody know, too, that if you have questions about the program or about, you know, what you saw on the slideshows today, you can feel free to email me, James Phelps, and you can reach me at PPS success with the Dean, D-E-A-N, at ppssuccess.com email address, and I'm happy to answer any of your questions.
All right, everyone. Thank you. James, always a pleasure, bud.
Likewise, Paul. I'll talk to you soon.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye, everyone. Thanks, everybody. Bye-bye.